So I'm going to need your spirit and goodwill today. I have a cold. I'm working on about 2.5 hours sleep. And I just gave an hour and a half lecture on Auschwitz. So there's an energy issue here and a clarity of mind issue. So as soon as things go wrong, you must leap on me and say, you know, that you're hallucinating or whatever it is. And I will see what I can do. The section on morality. Begins with a discussion of Kant's postulates of pure practical reason. For Hegel, for complicated reasons I'll try to elaborate, the conception, Kant's conception of the highest good and of the postulates of practical reason are the truth of Kant's system as a whole. That is, he thinks this is where you really get into what the fundamental stakes of the Kantian system are and where it unravels. And you can see it unraveling, as it were, before your eyes. So it's a bit of Kant that a lot of Kant scholars do not pay much attention to. The postulates only really occur in the second critique, although the notion of the highest good already appears in the first critique. And it looks like it could be an excessive bit. So I'll have to explain why, what it is and why Hegel thinks it's central. Well, the concept that's at the heart of this is the concept of the highest good, the summum bonum. And maybe we'll study the Kant's moral philosophy. You're raising your hand as if, yeah, but I don't want to admit it. Okay. So say when this goes unclear, if it does. The concept of the highest good goes something like this. We should seek our own moral perfection and the happiness of others as a categorically obligated end. That the highest good is a necessary concept of reason. But unlike the moral law itself, act only in the maxim that you can will that it be a universal law, unlike the moral law itself, the highest good is an a priori constructed object of rational striving. And if you actually look at contemporary moral philosophy, Rawls and Nora O'Neill all talk about constructions of reason. And this is the model of a construction of reason, is the highest good. Well, where does it come from and what kind of construction is it? Well, the moral law itself is normally thought of as a constraint on rational choosing. That is, I should only choose those maxims that conform to the moral law. That can be universalized. So it kind of tells me the minimum conditions necessary for rational willing. And therefore, it tells me it's a way of determining which acts must necessarily be done, which acts are permitted, and which acts ought not to be done. Now, for Kant, we need this norm because we are both rational and natural creatures. creatures. That is, we have that for Kant, there are, and this is fundamental to Kantianism, there are two independent springs of action. That, namely, that there are desires and there is reason. And both of them are springs of action, that is, sources of telling us what to do. In the case of desires, right? The end of all desires is happiness. And the end of all reason is virtue. So we are, for Kant, divided creatures. And we're not just divided creatures, but we are intrinsically divided creatures. What I mean by that is the following. You remember the last time I said that there are two notions of will. Vila is the rational will. Willkür is what's called the actual will. Which is to say, Willkür is the power to choose. A power of action. Now, Kant claims, how do I want to do this? So the first thing to notice is that for Kant, this domain, the domain of desires, happens in accordance more or less with natural law. And that's why he thinks of it as a source of pathology. And like Hobbes, he thinks of desire as always the desire for self-preservation and finally for happiness. Desire is what keeps us moving. Desire is the principle of inertia for living beings. That is, with desire we stay in motion and we keep desiring until death. Stop desiring, you die. So for Kant, and he takes this perfectly seriously, you would not be an agent at all without desire. And therefore, you cannot, it's an analytic truth for Kant, that all desire is the desire for happiness. So therefore, because it's an analytic truth that all desire is the desire for happiness, then it is a truism for Kant that all human beings seek happiness, and they must seek happiness as living human beings. Now, the second thought that goes along with this is what Kant calls the principle of radical evil. Now, radical evil in Kant is really disappointing. Because it has nothing to do with evil, or very little to do with evil. What Kant calls radical evil is simply the propensity of Willkür to choose in accordance with given desire. Which is to say, we are constructed so that we always are tempted to give priority to non-moral motives. So radical evil maybe is thought of as another word for original sin. It's what makes us mortal and finite creatures. Now, because... So this is not the way that Professor Heller teaches Thomas. So, it's because we have this propensity that there really is a gap between the sensible and the intelligible. And it's because we are tempted to act in accordance with desires that moral laws are expressed by ought. Ought, which is what people think of as what morality is about. You ought to keep your promises. Well, the reason there's an ought there, and the only reason that morality concerns the ought, is because we're tempted not to keep our promises. Right? We're tempted to act on the basis of self-interest and happiness. So the very notion of the moral ought speaks to the gap between the sensible and the intelligible. That the oughtishness of morality is nothing but a continual reminder that we are natural creatures who are tempted to act on the basis of our desires for our own self-interest and to ignore the interest of others and to ignore the claims of reason itself. Therefore, there has to be a second spring of action, and the second spring of action is reason, right? And reason has to be, for Kant, intrinsically motivating, because if it wasn't, it wouldn't be able to quash our temptations to act on the basis of natural desire. So we have two ways in which we are pressed into action, by desire and by reason. And this is the idea that there are two springs of action belongs to all versions of moral Platonism, all theories that have this division between reason and nature. And that's the difference between moral rationalism and moral empiricism. Moral empiricism argues there's only one spring of action, desire. Okay, well, if this is the case, then really it's not sufficient that I merely obey the moral law. That is, you know, every time I'm tempted to act, I think, oh yeah, is it universalizable? Am I being selfish? Okay. You know, little voice in my head saying, you know, don't forget other folk and all that. Which sounds very tedious. On the contrary, if the moral law represents my higher self, my better self, myself as I ought to be, that is, should be really the spring of all my actions, then I have a duty not simply to act on the moral law, but to make myself the kind of person that routinely obeys the moral law. And therefore, I have to become the kind of person that finds the moral law the overriding, that I want to make my will a will that, since we're talking about propensities, has a propensity to obey reason rather than desires. which is to say that I have now a, so it's a reiteration. If we have the moral law, then I must have the obligation to make the moral law the law of my will. And if I have the obligation to make the moral law the law of my will, then I have to have the idea of making myself a, and now the word operates, a virtuous person, where a virtuous person would be one that, near as damn, responds to the incentives of the moral law rather than the incentives of desire. So, the highest good for me, not just the good, but the highest good, must be involve my striving to become virtuous, and the object of this moral striving, which is now I'm calling the highest good, is therefore a product of reason itself. So the thought here, some people say, that Kant is a deontological thinker and not a teleological thinker. That in Kant there are no, ends of action. And I'm saying, no, that's not quite right. It's not quite right in working out the details. It's true that the moral law itself is deontological, it's just a principle, act in this way. But if you reiterate the moral law, I must make the moral law the law of my will, then I construct an object of rational striving so that there really is an end, an ultimate end, which I am trying to realize. So even Kant, so this is the idea of a constructed object of moral striving. It's how I turn a deontological principle into a teleological end. Now, the question now arises, I'm striving to make myself virtuous. What happens to happiness? And Kant says here, we can't give up the notion of happiness. And indeed, we think that the disconnection, that there are these, the problem here, there are these two independent sources of action. And the question is, how do they relate to one another? And so far, the answer is, they don't relate to one another very much. Reason tells desire what it ought not to do. And desire keeps saying, I want to be happy. So, what we would want, all things being equal, is a world in which happiness was proportionate to virtue. That the highest good would be a world in which people achieved happiness in direct proportion to their achievement of virtue. Well, what kind of idea is this? This is the idea of the highest good. Happiness should be rewarded in proportion to virtue. Why must we have that? That's the highest good. How necessary? Well, for Kant, the thought is something like this. And he brings this up in the Critique of Judgment, in a variety of different places. He says, look, in the actual world, there's something very disturbing. And what's very disturbing is the following. That the evil flourish and the virtuous go to the wall. And we find that morally disturbing. That is, we find it, a world that is out of kilter if the people who are happy, right, I mean, no one really thinks that virtue is happiness. You know, that's Socratic malarkey, right? You know, I keep doing my good, and the fact that I'm hungry and poor, and people kick and spit on me, but I'm happy. I mean, come on, Socrates. You know, no one thinks that. You know, and that's really ignoring desires altogether, ignoring this as an independent spring of action. But that means that we find that the disproportion between virtue and happiness to be a source of moral incoherence in the empirical world. Then that ought not to be the case. And that a properly moral world, or to use Zita Hendricks' phrase, a moral image of the world would be a world in which happiness and virtue cohere. That the evil suffered, the buggers, and the nice guys finished first. And Kant thinks we cannot, this is not, and I want to be clear here, Kant claims that this is not that this is not a motivational issue, and it's not, you know, happiness isn't a reward for virtue. That's not the claim. And it's not claiming that we should only be virtuous, therefore, because we'll become happy. That would be opposed to everything Kant believes. It's rather this thought that there is, let's call it, a problem of the moral intelligibility of empirical experience. That is, it's that we find the disproportion between virtue and happiness itself a form of moral disorder. And because we find it a source of moral disorder, we have an obligation to seek the highest good and hopefully inhabit a world in which virtue and happiness cohere. That's not the postulate for Kant. That's the rational, the summum bonum, the highest good, is really the good. It's the object of striving. That's what we're striving after. The question now is, what are the necessary conditions for the possibility of the highest good? That is, if it's the case that the highest good is a necessary object of moral striving, necessity being the crux here, then we are morally committed to seeking it. But old Kantian principles ought implies can. So the question is, how possible? That is, what is assumed by the idea of moral perfection and the idea of happiness in proportion to virtue? In Kant's sense, there are three postulates of pure practical reason. The first is irrelevant to this argument, is the existence of freedom. You have to believe in three selves. The second is the immortality of the soul. And the third is the existence of God. How come? Well, the necessary object of moral striving is moral perfection. I don't know about you, but I ain't going to make it in this life. Even another, you know, 15, 20 years, I'm still going to be really imperfect. I have really lots of really nasty incentives. In fact, I'm kind of hoping that the nasty incentives grow as I get older. I keep kind of thinking, well, I could use some more nasty incentives. Anyway, so Kant says, I need time. if we're going to have that object as the true object, necessary object of our striving, we need time to achieve it. And an ordinary lifetime is not enough. So we postulate the immortality of the soul so that it can be an infinite striving. We can keep on striving forever and ever and ever to, you know, get there. And you know, we won't get cut short by stuff like death. Second, I just said that the order of desire, which belongs to nature, and the order of reason obey completely separate laws. One of them obeys the laws of cause and effect. The other obeys the law of morality. If they obey totally separate laws, then there's nothing about their independent structures that permits coordination. So if we have to, if we must believe that the highest good is virtue, happiness in proportion to virtue, then what we need is somebody that will take care of it. And that somebody is God. That is, the job of God here is to provide a coordination between the laws of nature and the laws of morality. And there's a way in which, my supervisor, W.H. Walsh, used to say, that there's a way in which we all the time, Walsh says, practically believe in God. How come? Well, I just said that. So let me just set up at a minimal level, rather than the happiness principle. Think of it this way. I'll pick on Scott. Scott is suffering. We know this. So I want to do the moral thing, and of course I know it's a moral law to aid those in distress. It's an imperfect duty. And I want to give him solace and comfort. So I said, it's going to be all right. And I grab him. Now what happens if the very gesture of grabbing causes him intolerable pain? See? He's rubbing the shirt, right? The thought is, I actually have to believe that my actions can affect the world in the way I intended to affect the world in order to act morally at all. So I have to believe there's a minimal coordination between my moral reasoning, right, and the laws of the natural world. Otherwise, I couldn't act at all. I mean, if everything you did turned into the opposite, you know, you wouldn't be able to act. So you actually have to trust the world, call it God, right, that there's going to be a ordinary coordination between the structures of reason and the structures of nature. If you think that, then practically, a Kantian would argue, you believe in God. It's not that you have an idea in your head, right? It's that if these two are a priori discoordinated, and yet your action presupposes their harmony, then what's the ground of your action? Nothing you know. Therefore, you actually must believe that there's a power that lets you act morally. And that would demonstrate, according to Walsh, in a famous lecture he gave, belief in God. Okay. That's Kant's version of the highest good. And you can see that it's deep. It's deep. Why? Because fundamentally, it's thinking about
this duality in Kant, which is the duality finally between phenomena and noumena, and therefore about reason and the world. So that the postulates of pure practical reason are the place in Kant where all the issues about the relationship between freedom and nature come to a head, and where he has to, as it were, fight through them. That's Hegel's assumption. Now, Hegel any questions about that before I do Hegel's reconstruction of this? Yeah.
Really quickly.
Yeah.
Does that mean the moral thing cannot be false? Because the
must actually act. It's a law of action. It covers maxims of action. As my old friend Cornelius Castoriadis used to say, he said, like my old thinker, he said, look, nothing's going to stop me from thinking about killing my father and sleeping with my mother. Right? And worse. And worse. Yeah. I'm going to have these dreams you wouldn't believe. Our fantasies have nothing to do with our moral humanity. It's not what we think. It's what we do. That is, everyone has evil thoughts. If they don't, then they really need therapy, right? Then we've got terrible repression going on. So Kant is not trying to make a principle of what we can think. It's what we will... Again, moral law covers maxims of action. That is, those maxims I'm acting on when I... So the kind of basic intentions that are the springs of my actions. That's what they're about. Yeah?
But it can't just be about intended results, because if I do the right thing for the wrong reasons, it's still the same action, but it's
not about results. Yeah, but the Kantian idea is that because, very important, and I'll show you how Hegel makes a lot of this, because of this dual structure, Kant says, look, I can't be responsible for consequences because at the end of the day, they're not under my control. Right? I don't know, I try to do this and I cause you intolerable pain. That's outside my control. I did what I thought was, right? I intended the act of aiding someone in distress. So the only thing I can control, and this is why Kant is a Stoic, are my intentions. Right? Which he calls the maxims of action. So what I have to bring under the moral law, what the moral law regulates, are only the maxims of my action. And my goal is not only to adopt morally good maxims, but to be the kind of person who adopts morally good maxims. That's the reiteration, right? So it's not so Kant has his own virtue ethics. So Kant has his own notion of virtue and his own notion of teleology. You can get a lot out of the moral law. So it's a much more capacious system than it first appears. So Hegel is going to reconstruct these in his own inimitable fashion. But he's going to reconstruct it on the basis, I would argue, of its deepest fundamental impulses.
So right in paragraph 599. So the structure of Hegel's analysis is paragraphs 599 to 609 give us a construction, a generation of the postulates themselves. And then there's a bit of talking about representation. And then the second section on dissemblance and duplicity shows that the working out of these postulates falls apart. So setting them up, deconstructing the intuition. So how, and what I love about the Hegel, I have to say, is that in a way, his reconstruction is at some level even more persuasive than Kant, I find. I try to make Kant persuasive, but as Kant presents it, it's not very persuasive. I try to say there's, I think, a deep thought in Kant. Hegel's reconstruction, I think, is very clever. So it begins in paragraph 599, and there he talks about the relationship between consciousness and its other, which is nature. And he says, this otherness, because duty constitutes the sole aim and object of consciousness, is on the one hand a reality completely without significance for consciousness. So on the first thought here, this is as a moral being, the world out there makes no difference to my consciousness of what is involved in me being a moral being. And so it's pushed aside. And then he says, and the language is so interesting because it's so psychoanalytic, he says, because this consciousness is so completely locked up within itself, it behaves with perfect freedom and indifference towards this otherness. So the idea of reason not trying to figure out the world, but just trying to regulate itself, that motion is what generates the duality between freedom and nature, is the way the argument's going to run. So he says, and therefore the existence of this otherness, on the other hand, is left completely free by self-consciousness. An existence that similarly is related only to itself. And now we get the kind of dualistic setup. The freer self-consciousness becomes, the freer also is the negative object of its consciousness. The object. The object thus has become a complete world within itself, with an individuality of its own, a self-subsistent whole of laws peculiar to itself, as well as an independent operation of those laws and a free realization of them. In general, a nature whose laws, like its actions, belong to itself, as a being that is wholly indifferent to moral self-consciousness, just as the latter is indifferent to it. So the thought here is, where does the idea of a disenchanted nature come from? Well, one way of trying to get at the idea of a disenchanted nature is to think of the mathematization of nature. But here, Hegel's doing it differently. He's doing it from the perspective of self-determination. So he asks, if we really believe, and from the French Revolution we know we do, that we are really free and self-determining, that is, if we really think we have the power of the negative, which is to say the power to be independent of the natural world, we really believe all that, then we really believe we can
give the law to ourselves, that we can be, as it were, law-making. But we know that the idea of giving a law to ourselves is only possible because we're consciousness. Right? That is the nature of us being conscious beings that allows us to be self-legislating. So if we're self-legislating, then that assumes that the laws we give ourselves are incompatible with what exists outside us. So what exists outside us is, let's just say, something with its own laws, which of course is exactly what Kant says. There are two bodies of law, the laws of nature, cause and effect, and the laws of reason, which is reason's self-determining action. But for Hegel, and there's a hint of this in Kant, by the way, all of this derives from the very idea of freedom and self-determination and a morality that corresponds to that. So a fundamental absolute duality between morality and nature, or as Hegel puts it, an absoluteness of morality versus an absoluteness of nature. Well, once you've got those two absolutes, you know you're in trouble. Whenever two absolutes meet, right? You know, it's two elephants in a bar, right? There's just not room for both of them. Something's got to give. So, Hegel thinks that the simplest way then to generate, so for Hegel, the first postulate is simply, if there are these two absolutes, well then, there has to be some kind of harmony or reciprocity between them. So for Hegel, the first postulate is in fact the postulate of the highest good itself. That is, rather than thinking of the highest good as a construction of reason, he does it simply from the coordination problem of the relationship between happiness and morality, where happiness is just a code word for nature. Why is happiness a code word for nature? Well, for two reasons. One, desires are natural. That's nature within us. But secondly, it's a simpler thought. It's this. When I act from a desire, in a principle, I act from a desire. Desires are the content. For Kant. Maxims come from desires. So whenever I act, I have a desire. Which means every action has an end or a purpose. It makes Scott feel better. If every action has a purpose, then every action is, in a sense, if the purpose is satisfied, then I've realized my desire. If I've realized my desire, what is it to realize a desire? That's happiness. That's what happiness is. The realization of a desire. Right? That's analytic, right? That's the principle of, that's why utilitarianism says, right, it's the greatest happiness for the greatest number, because analytically, for utilitarians, every action is for the sake of pleasure or happiness. Why? Because it comes from desire. So just the thought that actions are purposive and ends, achieving our ends gives us pleasure, that's happiness. It therefore means that every action raises the coordination problem between happiness and morality. This is the way Hegel sets it up. And therefore, it's why he says that moral consciousness, paragraph 602, cannot forgo happiness and leave this element out of its absolute purpose. So I both want to, in every action, if I'm a moral person, in every action, if I'm a moral person, I want to obey the moral law, and I want to be happy. And because those two things divide, then I must postulate their harmony or coordination. So Hegel says, still in paragraph 602, the harmony of morality and nature, or since nature comes into account only insofar as consciousness experiences its unity with it, right? The harmony of morality and happiness, right? So again, the reason happiness is nature is because I only, as it were, touch nature where it's the point of my action, that is where I actually do something, and it's the point of my action is to achieve something. So every action in that sense seeks happiness. So the harmony of morality and happiness is thought of something that necessarily is, that is, it is postulated. Now, what makes this interesting is this is nature without. This is external nature. So it's odd that external nature only comes up in the question of happiness. But the reason, again, is because it's the ends of action, right? And consciousness touches nature in its action. There's also now the issue of nature within. That is, my own desires and inclinations, that is, nature within me. And here too, he says, I require a coordination. That is, I require that my inclinations and instincts and desires become or conform to duty. So my goal is to make it such that my inclinations incline towards morality rather than inclined, it's called, towards the ego. Since morality is the superego, then the question about my inclinations is, will my desires incline toward the superego or incline towards the ego? Well, if I'm going to be a moral person, I've got to try to bring them again into conformity with morality, with the superego. So I postulate, right, that my sensuous being conforms to morality. And this is so I and that's what it means that I must again seek virtue, seek to become a virtuous person. So Hegel says now, and already now, this is going to be the immortality of the soul. And as you'll see, when he does this, he can't. I mean, it's so absurd. Even though it sounds so plausible, of course we have to seek to make ourselves more virtuous.
It sounds so rational. And, of course, we need time, right? We need time for a lot of stuff. To become bad, to become good, we need time. But he can't resist, at this point, both generating the postulate and immediately generating some of the contradictions. So in the middle of paragraph 603, he says, consciousness has, therefore, itself to bring about this harmony between inclination and morality, of making progress in morality. But the consummation of this progress has to be projected into a future infinitely remote. And you may say, infinitely remote. Is that because I need time? Hegel says, no. It's not the problem of time in Hegel. For Hegel, it's infinitely remote because of the bar. The problem is this, and I'll read the passage after I explain it. The problem is, morality, as I said to you, the ought of morality, only exists because of the, we're inclined to act, Vilcor is inclined to act in accordance with desire, not morality. If I was not so inclined, there'd be no morality. There'd be no ought. I would automatically and spontaneously do what's right. But automatically and spontaneously do what's right is not morality. That's the end of morality. It's morality stops at that point. So if we think that we are moral beings, then it's because we think we're imperfect beings, that is, people who cannot ever cross the bar, and therefore we are allowed to infinitely, infinitely, infinitely get closer and closer, but never get there. And never allowed to get there, because if you did, there'd be no more morality, no more ought, and therefore, well, how come the point of morality be no more morality? That would be a contradiction. I'm going to be moral. Why? So I don't have to be moral. Why not just not be moral now? Good idea. No, you should. It fundamentally, Hegel thinks that is the comedy of Kantianism. That there is a kind of comic structure here, which he is going to call deceptions and duplicity. Right? That's why he's going to have that structure. It's going to be about self-deception all the time. So he says, for morality is only moral consciousness as negative essence. That's the way of saying it's about ought. And you know, let me just say over and over again, every moral philosophy you read says morality is about the ought. Right? The reason why in my Adorno book I say as long as there's an ought, we're in trouble. That the job of a post-Kantian morality is morality without ought, without must. Ought and must are the language, as I often say, of adolescence. You ought not do that. You know, you ought not stay out past 11 o'clock, because you know what happens then, right? It's all, ought is all about rampant teenage hormones. And the fact that they're out of control and parents can't bear it. So they invented this thing called morality. I really think that, right? So this is why Critchley and I can barely talk about morality, right? He thinks there really is an ought. That's what Levinas is all about. And I say, yeah, grow up. So here's Hegel. The argument is not so one-sided when we're both here. For morality is only moral consciousness as a negative essence. For whose pure duty sensuousness has only a negative significance, it is only not in conformity with duty. That is, this is the principle of radical evil. That's what he's talking about here. But in that harmony, morality qua consciousness, its actuality vanishes. just as the moral consciousness or in the actuality morality, the harmony vanishes. I'll get back to the vanishing in a moment. The consummation, therefore, cannot be attained, but is to be thought of merely as an absolute task, i.e., one which simply remains a task. Yet at the same time, its content has to be thought of as something which simply must be and must not remain a task. So it's both a task and an absolute, and that's how it becomes, and that's roughly what makes up the postulate. We postulate its existence as an object of infinite striving. And right away, Hegel says, this is just going to be contradictory, isn't it? Strictly speaking, we shall have to say that a definite idea on this point ought not to interest us, and ought not to be looked for because it leads to contradiction, the contradiction of a task which is to remain a task and yet ought to be fulfilled, and the contradiction of a morality which is no longer to be a moral consciousness, not actual. That's the contradiction. So one of the puzzles, and now trying to answer some of the questions that came up last week, is, you know, Rossio says, yeah, but, you know, what am I supposed to do? And I say, you mean, what ought you to do? There are no oughts in Hegel. And we can now see why. That's why Hegel will not tell you what to do. Right? He'll give you a way of thinking about what might be done. And he's not denying that there are, as it were, oughts in the world. But he doesn't think that philosophy should be, that is, the fundamental structure of the world, should be oughtish. Because then you get what? This is a version of the unhappy consciousness. This is the idea of an infinite striving for an object you cannot ever achieve. So that's the second principle. The third principle of morality. He uses God in two ways. First of all, he does God for this coordination problem. That is, God is to reward virtue with happiness because he's a nice guy. And then something else. And something else is this. And it is a puzzle within Kantian theory. And this is, we had this discussion with Christina. It's this question of, I should make the moral law the spring of my action. Yeah? So I should always act in a way that I act for the sake of the moral law. So, when I help Scott, which is to say, aid someone in distress, I'm doing it not because I care about Scott. That would be deeply plausible. It's rather because I want to act in accordance with the moral law. So, as it were, the idea of always acting for the moral law leads me to only fulfill it for the sake of my own self-perfection. Which is to say, only the moral law counts, and helping others is only a means? Well, that's unacceptable. And this is where God comes in. So the problem here is there's a contradictory structure between universal and particular. That I'm to seek the universal, right? And the particular is only a means, right? To the end of my universalistic perfection. But then that means my practical moral laws are not moral laws at all. They're really means to my self-realization. Well, that sounds nasty. It is nasty. So, God, being God and a nice guy, says, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to tell you that all your concrete duties, helping Scott, you know, helping they're sacred too. So God comes in and coordinates universal in particular by saying that all concrete duties have the same sacredness as all the moral idea itself. Now, so roughly the thought is, without God, I'm not a self-sufficient moral agent for Kant on this analysis. Only God and me working together can kind of make it the case that I do what I need to do and achieve morality. So the argument in sum looks like this, that, and now I'm just quoting from Hippolyte, page 474, nature and morality are indifferent to one another, and yet nature must be dependent on morality. Right? That's the issue, that they both are independent, and that yet they must be a way in which nature is dependent on morality or coordinated or in harmony with it. A synthesis must therefore be postulated which reconciles these opposed terms. The synthesis is presented in itself in the first postulate. Right? The in itself of the object of morality is postulated as for morality. The for itself in the second postulate, not only must I morality morally concrete with nature in itself, I must myself make myself morally perfect. And in the third postulate, I coordinate with the divine legislator in whom nature and morality are coordinated, and therefore this morality in and for itself. So, now Hegel calls this, and I'll stop with this thought and we'll have a break, the moral view of the world. And the reason why now, it's terribly important, is he's trying to say we can reconstruct the meaning of Kant's system as a whole on the basis of his moral ontology. That when we start with that opening structure of indifference, of consciousness locked up in itself, right? Or as Melanie Klein would put it, in the paranoid schizoid position. That is, you begin with the loss of the world. And then you have to figure out how to get the world back. So the structure, the argument is that Kant's whole system can be viewed as beginning with the principle of consciousness, and that this entire structure of the world, of freedom, consciousness, nature, happiness, virtue, all of it, right, comes from his moral view. Hegel is taking absolutely seriously Kant's opening thought. That is, I have limit knowledge, make room for faith, for freedom. That is the limiting of knowledge. That's the bar. Limit nature so that there's something outside of it. That's the condition of freedom. If that's right, then the entire structure of the Kantian system is encapsulated in the postulates of pure practical reason. Okay, let's have a break there. And then we'll see how it unwinds and quickly move on to conscience. It unwinds very quickly. Not even interesting. Well, I'm glad.